Of course they did, cutting in side to side against lifted, blocking arms. And fine indeed was that ridged armor, Amber realized, for the dwarf's arms remained intact against solid hits from those magnificent drow blades. The dwarf kept advancing steadily and unbothered. Around went the drow swords, one coming in again from outside in, the other retracting and stabbing straight ahead. And the dwarf became as insubstantial as fog, the stabbing sword hitting nothing tangible. With a yelp of surprise, the drow wisely turned and fled, but he had only gone a few strides when the dwarf reconstituted just to the side as the fleeing drow passed, and despite the drow's quick turn and dodge, sword slashing in a frenzy, the dwarf came on with a barrage of punches. His short legs pumped furiously, driving him against the drow, driving the drow against the far wall. The drow tried to scamper out to the side one way, then the other, but the dwarf cut him off expertly. No novice this. The drow struck out ferociously, one sword blocked by a grabbing hand that slid down the blade to cup the drow's hand, and with a deft twist of his wrist, the dwarf turned his hand over and slid his gauntlet spike into the drow's wrist and forearm. The other sword got through, a solid slash atop the dwarf's shoulder, but if the battle rager was at all wounded, he didn't show it. Nay, he just kept boring in, and when the drow retracted, he grabbed that arm. The drow tried to hold him back and tried to get away, but the dwarf methodically lowered his head and slowly pushed in. The helmet spike went against the drow's fine armor, and how the dark elf squirmed. "No, no," he pleaded. The dwarf offered a soft whisper of "shh" in reply, his powerful legs continuing to drive him forward. The drow went into a frenzy, dropping his swords and pulling his hands free to pound at the dwarf, but the dwarf bored in, the helmet spike finally pressing through fine drow armor. The drow gasped and grunted, squirmed and continued to flail, but ever slower, as the helmet spike slid into his chest and stabbed at his heart. The spike was against the wall then, fully through the poor victim, but the dwarf kept methodically driving onward. The drow fell limp, and the dwarf finally came back from the wall, standing straight and with the slain dark elf bobbing weirdly, impaled atop his helm. Blood spewed freely from the impaled corpse, showering the dwarf. Amber nodded eagerly at him, but her smile disappeared when the dwarf heaved the drow up, pressing him off the spike, and lifted his face to bask in, nay, to drink, the pouring blood. A long while later, he dropped the corpse to the ground, grabbed the drow by the hair, and dragged him along as he came toward Amber. She shook her head and tried to speak, which of course just filled her mouth with wretched foam.
"But aren't ye a lovely sight?"
the battle rager said when he stood before her, and he dropped the dead and drained drow fully to the stone and reached a bloody hand up as if to stroke Amber's face. She recoiled instinctively, only then fully grasping what it was that stood before her. An undead monstrosity, a vampire. She tried to speak again to ask him who he was, and simply spat out a line of wretched foam. How she hated these dark elves, and she almost wanted this undead creature to kill her then and there.
"Pleasant little lovely,"
the vampire said with a puzzled look and a mocking snort. He looked at her shackles.
"I'd break ye free, but them drow would get ye and blame ye for their dead."
He paused, as if another thought had suddenly come to him, and the look that came over his face chilled Amber to the bone.
"Might be another way, eh?"
His hand came up again, tenderly. And so discordant that movement rang to Amber, for the gauntlet was still liberally dripping the blood of his dark elf victim. She shuddered and shrank back, shaking her head and pleading with him with little mewling sounds. The battle rager paused, his hand hovering near to her, his expression shifting through a myriad of emotions, from eagerness to puzzlement to consternation and ending with a little feral growl. Amber sucked in her breath. swallowed a bunch of the putrid magical foam in the process, and vomited all over the ground between herself and the vampire.
"I'm looking that wretched to ye, eh?"
the undead dwarf roared, and he lifted his hand as if to strike. But he pulled back, shaking his head, muttering to himself. Fighting his urges and his hunger, Amber realized. And then something else came over him, and he looked off into the distance, up the tunnel and higher. He muttered something that sounded like,
"The graves!"
And he stomped his heavy boot.
"Ah, ye thieving dogs! Ye let him be, me king!"
He had gone mad, clearly. And Amber believed her life to be at its end, believed that this vicious creature would then tear her apart. But he didn't. He ran off up the tunnel, but skidded to a stop and came running back the other way. Down went one spiked fist, driving hard into a drow corpse, and down hard went the other hand on the second corpse, like a gaff hook pulling a fish up the side of a boat. A drow corpse tucked under each arm, the dwarf ran away down the tunnel. He came back a short while later, and Amber knew it was him, although he was in the form of a flapping bat then, and he went right past her without a notice, back the other way. He had moved the bodies, so that she could not be blamed for the murders, she realized. The captured dwarf cleric fell back against the wall, overwhelmed and terrified. She slid down to the floor and sat there, crying, spewing foam with every chortle, cursing the dark elves and cursing life itself. And at times, at least, savoring the revenge, feeling again her pick inside her torturer's skull. With that thought in mind, she began digging that pick into the sandier areas of her limited run, obscuring the blood and brain matter. The three friends and Guinevere, moving along at the back of the procession, turned a corner into a wide, straight corridor lined with doors on either side.
"Slow,"
Regis whispered. For with his low-light vision, the halfling could see Brunner down at the other end of the corridor, just out of their light radius, where this passage ended in a sharp right turn. The dwarf crouched and looked back, his hand held up to his approaching friends. Regis looked to Ketty Bree and Wolfgar and whispered,
"Wait."
He noted that Ketty Bree had already stopped and was already nodding her agreement. She had one hand on Guinevere and could clearly feel the tenseness within the panther. Guinevere sensed something nearby, some enemy likely, Regis could see and Ketty Bree could feel. After a few heartbeats, they started off again slowly, moving toward Brunner, who was still some 20 strides away. Once more, though, Regis held out his arm to stop the others as Brunner swung around, coming fully into their corridor and throwing his back to the wall at the corner. Up came his axe, clutched tightly diagonally across his chest, the many-notched head resting on the front of his left shoulder. He glanced back at his friends and smiled, then whipped around in perfect timing, his battle axe sweeping across to cut down the first of the monsters charging out of the side corridor.
"Goblins!"
Regis cried, recognizing the diminutive monster as it pitched over backward under the weight of Brunner's blow, big flat feet shooting forward from under it. Caddybree slapped at Guinevere's flank, and the panther leaped away, brushing hard against Wolfgar, who had already started his charge. Wolfgar staggered under the weight of the collision, but stumbled forward anyway, right past a door on the left-hand side of the corridor. And that door flew open behind him, and out poured more goblins, two abreast, war-whooping and waving their crude weapons. Another door down the corridor, just in front of the barbarian, burst open and still more poured out, shouting even louder. Regis leaped past Catty Bree, landing solidly with a powerful step and thrust, his rapier stabbing the throat of the nearest creature. Up came his second hand, hand crossbow drawn, and he let fly into the face of a second goblin in the front ranks. The monster shrieked and grabbed at the quarrel, stumbling aside, then getting thrown aside by the one behind it as it pushed through to stab at the halfling with its spear. But Regis already had his dirk in hand, and he caught the thrusting spear between its main blade and one of the side catch blades. "Aside," Catty Bree ordered. With a twist of his wrist, Regis snapped the end off of the crude spear. He feigned a counter but complied with Catty Bree instead, enacting his prism ring magic and warp-stepping to his right, farther down the corridor, leaving the opening for his magic-using companion. Up came Catty Bree's hands, thumbs touching, fingers fanned, and a wave of flames flew from her fingertips, engulfing the goblin clutching at its stabbed throat and the spear-wielder beside it, and the two behind them as well. And in came Regis from the side, rapier plunging home once and again to finish off the burning creature in the second rank, then going out a third time with brilliant speed, catching the nearest goblin in the third rank before it ever even realized that he was there. And Catty Bree was casting again, he heard, and a quick glance at her told him to hold the line back from her. At the other end of the hall, Brunner chopped down a second goblin, then blew aside a third and fourth in a single sidelong sweep. Four down already, squirming and dying, but the wild-eyed dwarf was far from sated, for behind those front ranks came larger creatures, hobgoblins and bugbears. Brunner Battlehammer hated nothing more than smelly bugbears. But he hated the one coming in at him even more in that moment, when it blocked his axe swing and countered with a heavy blow of its makeshift club, a club that looked very much like the thick thigh bone of a sturdy dwarf. Brunner accepted the hit, the bone slamming against his one-horned helm. In exchange, he bored in on the creature and caught a handhold of its high jerkin. It hadn't been a fair trade, of course, as the dwarf's ears were surely ringing. But he had to grapple this one and had to pull it back. For in flew Guinevere, right behind the bugbear as the dwarf tugged it forward.
"Ah, no ye don't," he said to the creature and to Guinevere, warding her away from this one. He spun around and heaved the bugbear the other way across the hole. "You're mine, ye dog!"
The bugbear, much taller and twice as heavy as Brunner, hadn't gone far, of course, and it howled and leaped for him, more than eager to grant him that wish. Brunner met the charge with his own fury, launching a series of short and powerful chops to drive his enemy back against the wall, his focus entirely on the bugbear, entirely on its weapon, entirely on his own decomposed leg. And that was his mistake, he suddenly realized. For while he couldn't help but hear the cries and roars of Guinevere's fury behind him, a second bugbear had slipped past the panther. And now its spear slipped through a seam in Brunner's armor, biting into the dwarf's back. Wulfgar fully recovered from the brush of the leaping panther and turned his attention on the hobgoblins and bugbears spilling out into the corridor from the door in front of him. He tried to make sense of the chaotic scene, but a couple of things struck him as curious. First, several of these goblin kin were not dressed in the typical hides or smelly sackcloth one might expect of such creatures, nor even in pilfered leather armor. No, they wore the fine dress of the dark elves, the smooth shirts and flowing capes, and even the fabulous armor. But even with that oddity clear to see, their demeanor seemed even more curious to Wulfgar. They had not burst out, as had the others, to leap into battle, it seemed, but rather to flee. And so the first in line, a thick-chested hobgoblin of around Wulfgar's own height, seemed hardly even aware of the barbarian's presence and made a last-moment, too-late attempt to block the heavy swing of Aegis Fang, the warhammer shattering its ribs and blasting its breath away and blasting the hobgoblin away to the ground. A second nearby brute lifted its club to strike, but Wulfgar was too close and caught it by the arm with his free hand. He shoved it away and yanked it back, and then brutally a second time, and then a third, and in this last collision, the barbarian snapped his forehead into the hobgoblin's face, splattering its nose. He hit the dazed creature with a second and a third headbutt, then threw it down to the floor before him, right in the path of a closing bugbear, which stumbled and lurched forward, putting its face right in the path of a swinging Aegis Fang. Wulfgar leaped and called out to his god, landing with a determined stomp of his boot onto the struggling hobgoblin's neck. The mighty barbarian reached for his silver horn, thinking of summoning reinforcements from the halls of his warrior god. He held back, though, when he at last realized the reason for the commotion with this group. In the room through the open door, more monsters battled, though most seemed to want only to flee. and in their midst swirled the scimitar dance the barbarian knew all too well, the brilliant spin of a martial display he had not witnessed in more than a century. Drizzt worked around a growing pool of blood, slicing through ranks of goblins, hobgoblins, and bugbears with wild abandon. Wulfgar reminded himself to focus on his own pressing needs, and almost too late, as a bugbear leaped in at him, sword raised above its head. He thrust out Aegis Fang straight ahead, spear-like with both hands, the heavy hammerhead thumping into the bugbear with jarring force. Not enough to stop the creature, but enough to buy Wulfgar the time he needed. The barbarian dropped his shoulder and drove forward, under the cut of the sword, and as the bugbear tried to regain its interrupted momentum, it pitched right over the bent-over man. Or would have, except that Wulfgar dropped his hammer and grabbed the tumbling beast as he came up fast, lifting the bugbear right over his head. He turned and flung it onto the opposite wall of the corridor, into another door, actually, which exploded under the weight of the impact, leaving the bugbear sprawled in a tumble of broken wood. The barbarian swung around. A pair of goblins leaped in at him, their spears thrusting, for now he appeared unarmed. Behind them stood another bugbear. And in the room beyond, Drizzt fought 1 against 10, and any momentum the drow had gained with his obvious surprise assault seemed gone by then.
"Drizzt!"
Wulfgar started to cry out, but his voice and his vision was stolen by a sudden flash of fiery light and a burst of heat that had him and everyone else in the corridor recoiling in shock. Caddybree's wall of fire rushed out from her, splitting the goblin ranks and rolling right in through the initial open doorway, and Regis fell away with a shriek, shielding his eyes from the stinging light and turning his face from the heat of the roaring flames. Inside the room he heard the squeals of the goblins, agonized and terrified. Confident that Caddybree had this area well in hand, the halfling stumbled farther along to join up with Wulfgar. As his sensibilities returned, the halfling came to see his choice as a fortunate one. Wulfgar was in trouble. 2 goblins assailed him, and one had stabbed its spear right into the barbarian's huge left forearm. Grimacing against the pain, denying it seemed, Wulfgar used that arm as a shield, forcing the spear to stay out wide while he fought off the second creature with Aegis Fang. And directly behind that goblin, the bugbear lifted a club that looked to Regis very much like one of the missing femurs. "Wulfgar!" Regis cried, charging ahead. A small snake appeared in the halfling's hand, and he flung it over the head of the nearest goblin and onto the chest of the tall bugbear. The serpent rushed up around the bugbear's throat. And before the tall and hairy goblinkin had even managed its swing, that leery, undead specter appeared over its shoulder, tugging it backward into the floor. Regis continued his charge, coming in fast against the nearest goblin, turning it aside from the speared barbarian with a series of powerful rapier thrusts. The goblin parried and tried to counter, but Regis lifted its spear up high with his now 2-bladed dirk and rolled his opposite shoulder underneath the lifting weapon, rapier driving up at an angle through the creature's diaphragm and into its lung and heart. At the same time, Wulfgar turned to the side and rolled his left arm around the spear so that he could grasp its bloody shaft. Grimacing harder against the pain, the barbarian roared and swung around, using the spear as his lever to swing the goblin back behind him and send it slamming into the far wall. It crumbled to the floor. Wulfgar didn't even bother to extract the spear at that moment, instead turning with the throw. Aegis Fang returned to his grasp as he turned, and he rolled the warhammer up high over his shoulder. The goblin popped up just as the overhead chop descended, the warhammer hitting the creature on top of the head with a sickening splat of bone and brain, the force driving its head right down into the cradle of its collarbones. Weirdly, the goblin sunk down on shivering legs, the blow so heavy that it tore one of its knees out of joint, and the energy rolled all the way down to the floor and back up again, the goblin bouncing right from the ground. It landed on its feet and somehow held that posture for a few heartbeats before tumbling over, quite destroyed.
"Behind me, Regis," Wulfgar ordered, spinning around to face the open doorway once more and the dark elf battling within.
Regis understood the command as a bugbear pulled itself from the pile of a shattered door, and the halfling was there in the blink of an eye, rapier jabbing at the hulking goblinkin. Down, Wulfgar shouted to Drizzt, and he launched Aegis Fang as he yelled, aiming right for the back of his drow friend's head.
Me leg! The furious dwarf screamed over and over, bashing the pinned bugbear with his shield and short-chopping his axe all around the creature. He even stomped on its bare foot with his heavy boot, anything to inflict pain on this ugly beast that has dared to raid his grave. He tried to ignore the burning pain in his back all the while, but futilely as the bugbear behind him drove its spear in farther. Around swung the dwarf, suddenly and ferociously, so powerfully that his turn yanked the spear from the bugbear's grasp. The creature was still reaching for the weapon as Brunner came around fully, rolling under and low with his shoulder, then springing up with a great uppercut of his axe that drove the blade up into the bugbear's groin. And Brunner growled, ignoring the fiery pain, denying it completely as every muscle in his body tightened with rage. He felt the strength of Clanget and Silverbeard coursing through his powerful limbs. Up rose his axe through the bugbear's pelvis, tearing skin and shattering bone. Then up went the bugbear as Brunner drove on. Clangadin roared inside the dwarf as the dwarf roared in defiance. Up and around went Brunner, lifting the bugbear right over his shoulder and heaving it forward at the end of his axe to crash into the bone wielder as that battered goblinkin tried to come forward once more to attack. And in flew the dwarf behind the bugbear, leaping high, axe spinning up higher, to come down with a devastating blow that nearly chopped the spear wielder in half. Again and again, Brunner's axe went up high and came thundering down into the bugbear tangle, severing limbs and gashing torsos, so that it was soon impossible to tell where one bugbear ended and another began. The dwarf heard a roar behind him but didn't turn, for he knew that call, Gwenivar's call, and it seemed to him one of power and victory. "Light!" Catibree cried, warned, and a moment later the corridor filled with dazzling brilliance. Light to which the companions could quickly adjust, but that put the goblinkin at a serious disadvantage. Regis was about to call on his dirk for the second snake, but the rising bugbear grimaced against the brilliance and threw its arm up instinctively to shield its eyes. In went the halfling's rapier, a series of sudden and powerful thrusts that dotted the bugbear's drow clothing with spots of blood. Regis didn't need his second snake. And as he continued his barrage of blows, easily finding holes in the bugbear's defensive shifts, scoring a hit with almost every thrust, he became convinced that he would never need such a trick facing up squarely against a monster such as this. He thought of Denala Topolino then, and their endless hours of training as he marveled at his own precision and speed. He thought more of Denala, of their lovemaking and bond, and the notion that she was away from him stung him and angered him. And the bugbear felt his wrath one poke at a time. Down, Drizzt heard his barbarian friend cry, and his heart leaped with joy as his thoughts careened back across the decades, to the point of reference that brought relevance to the barbarian's command. Fully trusting Wulfgar, Drizzt flung himself backward into the ground. He hadn't even yet landed, the two bugbears in front of him rushing in to take advantage when magnificent Aegis Fang flew fast above him, taking one of the surprised bugbears right in the chest and blowing it away. Drizzt's shoulder blades touched the floor, but up he came as if in a full rebound, his muscles working in beautiful concert to throw himself back up to face the remaining monster, and with his scimitars already leveled for the quick kill. Down spun that bugbear, struck a dozen times as the drow twirled off to his left, launching a wild flurry designed simply to keep the creatures there back from him to buy him time. He noted a couple of clear openings in the meager defenses presented against his flashing routine, but he held back, confident that the odds were about to turn in his favor. With a knowing grin, Drizzt spun back around to his right, similarly driving back the monsters on that flank. Even as he turned to face the new group, a goblin came flying past him, flailing wildly in midair. It clipped the weapon of the hobgoblin immediately facing Drizzt before bouncing far aside, and Drizzt used that distraction to suddenly step ahead with a killing thrust.
He retracted his bloody blade and launched it out behind him, then followed the backhand by turning with it, going around the other way once more, batting aside the spear and sword of a hobgoblin and bugbear, leaping above the spear thrust of a goblin, then managing to realign his left-hand blade as he descended to slash a downward chop across that goblin's face. He landed lightly and continued his turn, back the other way to intercept prodding weapons, and to smile at his old friend, his dependable battle partner, as Wolfgar charged in at the line. The hobgoblin down at that end turned to meet the barbarian and saw its advantage, and Drizzt smiled all the wider, knowing the deception all too well, and he continued his turn once more, before he even came around to face the remaining hobgoblin and bugbear on that flank. He heard a heavy splat and the grunt of a dying hobgoblin behind him. Aegis Fang had returned to Wolfgar's grasp. Drizzt had anticipated that, and the hobgoblin had not. Drizzt could only imagine the stupid look upon the creature's face when it suddenly realized, as Doom descended, that the huge man held his mighty weapon once more. He felt Wolfgar behind him then, back to back, and this time he met his enemies full on and without regard for what was behind him. He parried the sword and spear with dazzling efficiency, his left-hand scimitar, Twinkle, rolling over the hobgoblin spear once and then again, angling and turning on the second circuit so that Drizzt had the spear caught under one expanse of the scimitar's crosspiece and the in-turn bend of the weapon's curving blade. At the same time, so independently that the drow might have been two separate fighters, Drizzt lifted Icing Death at just the right angle to slide the bugbear's downward chop out to the side, and before the creature could retract and attack again, the drow quick-stabbed Icing Death straight out. It wasn't a heavy blow, of course, just a flick of the wrist, but the precision of the strike needed little weight behind it as it took the bugbear in the eye. The beast howled and fell back, leaving its poor hobgoblin companion straight up against Drizzt. The hobgoblin roared and tugged mightily, but it needn't have, for Drizzt gave a subtle twist that released the spear even as the creature began its pull. And so the hobgoblin overbalanced and stumbled backward, and Drizzt closed fast with a leap, scimitars dancing and whipping around. The drow landed and darted behind the hobgoblin, passing it on the left and going right behind, and before the creature could even react to the blinding dash, the drow came back around the other side, spinning into position where he had been standing before the beast in the first place. The hobgoblin stared at him incredulously, curiously. Then its look grew even more puzzled, as the truth began to dawn, apparently. "Yes, you really are dead," Drizzt explained, and down sank the dying hobgoblin, stabbed and cut a dozen times. The drow glanced back to see a goblin go flying at the end of a mighty swing of Aegis Fang. With a grin, Drizzt focused his attention on the remaining bugbear. Still holding its bleeding eye, the beast turned and fled through a side door, and as it opened the portal and rushed through, Drizzt saw another bugbear, this one holding a curious item. "The skull!" he yelled, pointing a blade at the heavy door as it slammed shut. The drow darted ahead and threw himself against the door, but it did not budge. "Wolfgar!" he called, bouncing off and turning to face his friend. Regis entered the room then, diving to the side to avoid getting bowled over by Guinevere, who came in roaring. Across the other way, Wolfgar let fly his warhammer at a retreating hobgoblin, catching it in the back of the head and pitching it headlong into the wall. In his other arm, the barbarian choked a second missile, a living missile, and he spun on Drizzt and lifted the kicking goblin up high. Two running steps built momentum at the door, and Wolfgar heaved the creature into it. The iron-banded wood groaned under the heavy hit, but the door proved the stronger, and the broken goblin crumpled down at its base.
"Betterkey is coming!" shouted Brunner, as he too ran into the room. "Your skull is," Drizzt started to yell at him, but the dwarf cut him short with, "I hear de elf!"
Brunner leaped into the air near Wolfgar, who half caught and half redirected him, putting his own strength behind the dwarf's momentum. Brunner tucked his shoulder tightly under his shield as he collided with the door, and this time the portal exploded inward, the dwarf bouncing through and bouncing right back to his feet to drive forward powerfully into two very surprised bugbears. Drizzt started for the opening, but in the mere heartbeats it took him to arrive, All that remained standing within the room was Brunner Battlehammer. Driz skidded to a stop and grimaced. His friend's back was soaked in blood, and not the blood spraying about him as he repeatedly chopped his axe upon one or the other of the destroyed bugbears. The drow looked to Wulfgar with concern, and only then realized that the barbarian too had not escaped the fight unscathed, and indeed had a piece of a broken spear sticking out of his left forearm, which, like Brunner's back, was covered in blood. "Where is Catti Bree?" he asked, and the words had barely left his mouth when a stroke of lightning flashed in the corridor beyond, the thunderous retort reverberating off the stones. Right behind that blast came Catti Bree, calmly entering, seeming perfectly composed, and with strands of bluish mist curling out of her sleeves and around her arms. She looked past the three to the broken doorway and to Brunner, coming back out of the side room and holding a skull up before his eyes.
"An old friend," the dwarf said, somewhat sheepishly, although he tried to cover that with a snicker. Clearly, though, Brunner was more shaken than he was trying to let on as he stared into the empty sockets that once held his own eyes.
Catti Bree beat Driz to his side and began casting a healing spell immediately after glancing over the dwarf's shoulder to take a closer look at his wound. The dwarf grimaced in pain as she put her hand up against that deep gash and against the remaining piece of spear that was stuck there, but he gradually unwound from that tightness as the waves of soothing magic brushed through him.
"Better?"
Catti Bree asked.
"Ah, aye, hands of magic,"
Brunner breathed, and his eyes went wide and Driz gasped as Catti Bree brought her hand back over his shoulder, holding the large spear tip that had been sunk into his back.
"You'll need more spells on that wound," she said.
"Do 'em on our way back to me grave, then," Brunner said.
"And Wulfgar, too," Driz added. "You three return to the cairn. Regis, Gwen, and I will remain here so we don't lose any of the ground we have gained." Brunner and his adopted children set off immediately, skull and femurs in hand.
"We should scout out the area," Driz remarked.
Regis had other ideas, however. He reached into his magical pouch of holding and brought forth a large, multi-layered and pocketed bag. He put it gently on the floor and began unwrapping it, revealing the pieces of his portable alchemy lab. He opened a large book, then flipped to a marked page.
"That lichen,"
he said, looking up from the picture in the book to a patch of mossy green fungus at the base of the room's wall.
"You go and scout, and keep Guinevere as relay. If you find any more of the lichen, gather it."
"For?"
"Many things, and probably many more I haven't yet discovered,"
Regis answered. He reached into one pocket and pulled forth a vial filled with a bluish liquid.
"And here,"
he said, offering it to Driz. The drow took it, looking at his halfling friend curiously.
"A potion of healing,"
Regis explained.
"Good to have until Catti Bree is back, at least."
Driz nodded and started away.
"Fire protection,"
Regis said suddenly, turning him back.
"The lichen, I mean. I think I can use it to finish a potion of fire protection, and if I'm to be marching beside Catti Bree, that is something I desire. She seems to favor the flame."
Driz smiled and nodded, his hand going to Icing Death, which similarly protected him, and his thoughts going to the ring he had given to Catti Bree that afforded her the same. He was thinking about the longer-term implications, fitting pieces of the greater puzzle together to find even more harmony and power within the group. He glanced one last time at Regis, who had buried his nose in his alchemy book and who was, obviously, musing along the same lines.
"Allow me," Wulfgar said.
Brunner, still holding the skull, looked at him and hesitated.
"Please," Wulfgar added. "Are ye sad that ye weren't there to bury your dad the first time?"
Brunner asked with a wry smile as he handed the skull over.
"Just respect," Wulfgar explained. "Respect owed to you."
He knelt beside the cairn and gently moved aside the stones.
"It is sobering,"
Catti Bree said, standing back with Brunner.
She draped her arm across the dwarf's sturdy shoulders.
I wonder how I will feel when I return to Mithril Hall and look upon my own grave.
Sobering, Brunner replied with a snort. Feeling more like I could use me a bit of the gutbuster.
He put his arm around his daughter's waist and pulled her closer. Wulfgar put the femurs back in place first, then tenderly placed the skull. Before he replaced the stones, he stood at the foot of the grave, where Catibri and Brunner joined him. As the woman consecrated the grave, Wulfgar and Brunner lowered their eyes. It proved a cathartic moment for this unusual family. They did not bury their past here, just their past differences, Wulfgar most of all. When Catibri finished her chant, he pulled the woman close in a tight hug.
Ever have I loved you, he said, but there was no tension there in his voice or between them. And now I am glad to be back beside you, both of you.
I didn't think you'd leave Eruladun to return to Toril, Catibri said.
Nor did I, Wulfgar replied. Curiously, I have not regretted my choice for a moment of the last 21 years. This is my adventure, my journey, my place.
Will you tell me about your wife and children in time? Catibri asked, and Wulfgar smiled wide and nodded eagerly.
Two lives, he said, as if he could not believe his good fortune. Or three, as I consider the two sides of my previous existence. Nah, just the one, Brunner decided. He stepped away from his children to the grave and kicked at one of the stones. He looked back at the pair, nodding as if in epiphany. What's in here's what's counting, he said, poking a stubby finger against his chest, over his heart. Not what's in there, he finished, pointing to the cairn.
The other two, who had passed through death, who also wore their second mortal bodies, could not argue that fine point.
Chapter 16 Resilience. The diminutive tiefling warlock strode angrily along the devastated section of Port Last, his dead arm swinging behind him, his bone staff tucked up under his other arm. Often he used that staff for support, but not now, not with his blood on fire with anger. They had taken his mother, if she was even still alive. They had destroyed his band of companions, his band of friends. Some of the citizens had seen Afrafrenfir down and dead. Some had seen Artemis and Treri dragged away, and Amber too. Poor Amber, hoisted upside down by her feet and jostled around like a plaything at the end of an enormous Drider's ugly arm. And Dalia had been beaten. Efren had seen that with his own eyes. When the lightning net had descended, so Efren had descended, reverting to wraith form and slipping into a crack between the cobblestones, rushing down and along the ground, then up between the planks of a nearby building. Fortunately, he had gone to the opposite side of the avenue from where Dahlia's magical weapon had redirected the lightning web energy, and how proud the young warlock had been to witness his mother enacting such a mighty blast as that. But he had witnessed the savage retribution of the male Drider as well, and even in his two-dimensional form, the tiefling warlock felt his breath leaving him as that monster battered Dahlia about the head, laying her low. And now she was gone. They were all gone, and Efren found himself alone. He thought of the Shadowfell and Drago Quick, once his mentor in what was once his home, but dismissed the thought with an angry shake of his head and a mutter of curses that had the many citizens moving about the disaster area looking at him curiously, as if he had surely lost his mind. They were not far off in their estimation of his emotional stability, he realized, as he took note of them. Efren was indeed nearly insane with anger and frustration and sheer hopelessness. He was alone now, 2 decades removed from his time. Was Drago Quick even still alive? And how far had the Shadowfell receded from the shores of Toril?
Efren doubted he could even shadow step back to that dark place, but he doubted even more that he wanted to. Likely he was an outlaw there, and would not survive for long. He came up before the smoldering rubble of Stonecutter's Solace, the inn a complete ruin from the magical fires and thunderous lightning of the Dark Elves' assault. Many had died in there. Almost a dozen bodies had been pulled out at last count. All around him, the folk of Port Last vowed that they would rebuild. These were hardy folk, resilient and stubborn, and their words gave Efren some comfort. He could go his way now, he realized, free to roam as he saw fit, free to build a new life. He was a warlock of no small power, after all, and powerfully outfitted. With the bone staff he had taken from the Skull Lord in the Shadowfell, he could raise an army of undead to do his bidding if it came to that.
"On my own," he said aloud, trying to bolster his own resolve.
But the words rang hollow, and their echoes were not welcomed in his thoughts, he found to his surprise.
"No," he said. "No."
He would go and find his mother. It would take him years, perhaps, but that was his place now, that was his guiding mission. He would find Dahlia and hopefully the others of their band, and he would destroy their captors, or he would die trying. That last thought surprised him, but mostly because that last thought did not bother him. If he died trying to save Dahlia, then so be it.
"So be it," he said aloud.
"So be what?"
asked a man near to him, and he turned to see that fellow and a companion regarding him curiously.
"First the damned sea devils, now the drow. Is Port Last cursed, do you think?"
The twisted warlock brought his staff out before him and tapped it hard against the cobblestones, feeling its resonating power, feeling his own inner strength.
"The world is a dangerous place," Efren said, "and that danger comes in all manners and enemies. Would you go to Waterdeep to be cut down by a highwayman's knife in an alleyway? Would you go to Baldur's Gate and be dragged off on a slaver's boat? Or would you build again, here in Port Last, and be ready next time should these drow dogs return?"
"Well said, young one," the man's companion said with a courteous bow.
Efren nodded and walked away. Yes, he decided. He would go and rescue his mother. But of course, he had no idea where to start.
"You do not seem overly bothered by this turn of events," Jarlaxle castigated Camuriel, when the psionicist at last arrived to his call in the empty back chambers of House Doerden. The psionicist shrugged as if it hardly mattered. "Did you not expect that this would happen someday?"
"I expected that things would continue to progress, and splendidly as they were."
"And you were miserable," Camuriel replied. "A most miserable clerk." Jarlaxle was starting to answer before Camuriel had even finished, but he bit back his response as he more fully realized the prescience of the psionicist's remarks.
"Even that was better than this," he said in exasperation instead. "Show some respect, houseless rogue, for you are in the presence of the captain of the guard of Daermon and Eshesbernon, more commonly known as House Doerden. Impressive, yes?"
"I am brimming with humility," Camuriel dryly replied.
"The returning army of House Bayenri will enter the city this day," Jarlaxle explained, "and dear matron Mother Quenthal has acquired a most interesting pair."
"The son of House Barrison Delarmco and his half-Darthir daughter, yes," Camuriel agreed. Jarlaxle looked at him, shook his head, and blew an exasperated sigh. Just once he would like to surprise Camuriel with some bit of information.
"She will use this retrieved Armgo to strengthen the bond between House Bayenri and Matron Mesbaris Armgo, no doubt. Or she will find a way to twist the young Armgo's situation to her advantage over Mesbaris. Either way,
She is determined to strengthen her hold on the whole of the city.
Matron Mother Quenthal has grown, Kim Muriel remarked.
Yes, she has grown tremendously somehow, through the use of an illithid, I believe, though my information is far from complete. Gromph drags Methyl L. Videnvelp along behind him.
Matron Mesbaris hates Matron Mother Quenthal profoundly, Kimuriel replied, and he did not seem surprised by Jarlaxle's information. As much as she hates anyone alive.
She is a matron of a powerful house, Jarlaxle reminded. Her personal vendetta matters not. She will choose pragmatism over anger.
Kimuriel nodded, hardly disagreeing. There is one who hates the matron mother of House Bayenry even more, he remarked. One who long ago abandoned any thought of anything other than revenge. Jarlaxle looked at him curiously.
My mother, Kimuriel explained. Kioral? She fell into the claw.
She was taken from House Oblodra before the wrath of Loth destroyed the structure and given to a great demon as a slave.
Jarlaxle's expression did not change. This was all new information to him.
Heir to the Baelor, Kimuriel explained. Kioral Odrin is its plaything, but she cares not. All that enters her mind for these many decades is her hatred of Matron Mother Evenel Bayenry and Evenel's children, including the new Matron Mother. She is single-minded, I assure you.
You speak as if you have met with her.
In my own manner, Kimuriel admitted. There is more to this tale. Matron Mesbaris entered into a conspiracy to release Kioral upon the city, upon House Bayenry specifically. Archmage Gromph was part of that conspiracy, along with a high priestess of another house.
Minol and Fay, no doubt,
Jarlaxle reasoned. He considered the current situation and realized that the matron mother had severed that conspiracy rather neatly. He looked at Kimuriel, still confused about how his compatriot could be in the know regarding so much interesting subterfuge of the spider's web that was Menzo Berenzon. But then, suddenly, it all sorted out to him, and very neatly.
So, Methyl L. Videnvelp is not as damaged as he seems to be, Jarlaxle said with a wry grin. Not so damaged that the Mind Flayer cannot contact its hive mind, perhaps.
Kimuriel nodded in deference to the fine reasoning.
So, Quenthal is now more akin to Evenel, and far more formidable, Jarlaxle remarked. And I am the captain of the Doerden garrison.
He shook his head and snickered at the sound of that, repeating,
the Doerden garrison.
Soon to be a noble house, seated on the council, no doubt, Kimuriel reasoned.
Replacing Zor Laren, I expect, said Jarlaxle.
And what is the place of Bregan D'Earth in all of this? Asked Kimuriel, but Jarlaxle could tell from the Psionicist's expression and demeanor that he already had the answer, whatever Jarlaxle might offer.
We will find our opportunity and our way, Jarlaxle assured him. There is a war coming, somewhere. There can be no other explanation for the machinations of the Matron Mother. She brings all others close now and holds them fast as her collective thrall.
She thickens her armor indeed, Kimuriel agreed.
There will be seams in that armor, Jarlaxle stated rather determinedly before he could catch himself.
Kimuriel offered a wry smile at his outburst.
I did not build Bregan D'Earth to see it turned into a faction of the House Bayenry garrison, Jarlaxle explained.
He hesitated then, thinking that he would be wise to temper his words. But as he considered it, it didn't really matter, for Kimuriel could read his thoughts as easily as listen to his words, even if the magical eye patch prevented psionic intrusion. So flustered was Jarlaxle at that time that he was wearing his emotions openly.
I will do as the Matron Mother commanded, for now, he told his co-leader. But this is a temporary arrangement. I did not escape this wretched hole in the ground, only to be pulled back in at the whim of my foolish si-
of the matron mother. Sister, Kimuriel added. And no, this is not a desirable detour for Brigandy Earth. They'll let us find the seams in my dear sister's armor, Jarlaxle offered.
Ms. Barris Armgo already has discerned one, Kimuriel replied.
Kiorl?
Indeed. It was a Bayenri, Tiago, who last slew and thus banished Ertu, and the Baelor will hold no love for that house.
Jarlaxle's smile widened so much that the psionicist apparently felt compelled to add,
Patience.
But of course, Jarlaxle thought, but did not say. He wanted Luskin back. He wanted Brigandy Earth back. He wanted to see the stars once more. And so he would, even if it had to be over his sister Quenthal's dead body.
Chapter 17. The Order Within the Chaos. The 8 ruling matrons of Menzo Berenzon gathered around the spider-shaped table in the secret council chamber, with Matron Mother Quenthal Bayenri and Matron Mes Barris Armgo taking their seats at the ends of the longest arms of the arachnid. Between them sat an empty chair, one that 7 of the ruling matrons expected would be filled in short order. But Matron Mother Quenthal knew better. This council had been long awaited, and indeed had been delayed longer than many had expected. Nearly all of House Orlaren was gone from the city now, and a few of the ruling matrons were surprised to see Xerath Qzorlaren in attendance and seated in the chair of the 3rd house to the right of Matron Mother Quenthal. Rumors had filtered throughout the city that Xerath had already departed. No matter, though, they all whispered, for surely this was the day of Xerath's formal withdrawal from the ruling council and House Orlaren's formal withdrawal from Menzo Berenzon. Their settlement in the dwarven complex, once known as Gontalgrim, was going splendidly by all accounts. Several houses had already set up trading arrangements with the Xorlarens, and indeed, some fine armor and weapons had already begun to flow back to Menzo Berenzon, crafted in the primordial forge. After the many obligatory prayers to the Spider Queen, led by High Priestess Sosumtu Bayenri, Matron Mother Quenthal called the chamber to order. Surprisingly, though, Sosumtu did not depart, as was the custom. She moved to the chair between the Matron Mother and Matron Mes Barris and calmly sat down, a movement that clearly did not sit well with the matron of House Barris and Del Armgo, who squirmed in her seat and openly glowered at the Bayenri High Priestess and then at Matron Mother Quenthal as well. "You know why we are gathered," the Matron Mother began. Matron Xerath Qzorlaren's expedition to the rediscovered dwarven mines has been quite successful and fruitful. By the will of Lolf, and as previously discussed in this very hall, it is time for us to rebuild that which was lost in the decades of tumult, in the war of the Spider Queen and the devastations of the Spell Plague. She looked to Xerath and bade her to speak. "The city of Qzorlaren is prepared," the old matron said as she stood. "We secure the halls, and the magical forge of the dwarves is fired once more, its flames the hot breath of a captured primordial." The declaration, though it was not news to anyone in the room, of course, brought a round of applause. "Qzorlaren is not an independent entity," Matron Mother Quenthal interrupted, stifling those cheers and drawing surprised glances from a few of the others, though the still-standing Matron Xerath's expression did not change. All of this had been long ago decided in private between the two, the others soon realized. "You have your city as you desired, Matron Xerath," the Matron Mother explained, "and your autonomy, to a point." Matron Mother Quenthal patted her hand in the air, bidding Xerath to sit down, and when she had, the Matron Mother continued, "Qzorlaren is a sister to Menzo Berenzon, and will pay a tithe, mostly in the form of armor and weapons, machines of war and the like. In its daily routines, Qzorlaren is Matron Xerath's own to rule as she sees fit.
But know this, my old rival, my old friend, my old enemy. In a time of need, Menzo Berenzon will call upon you, and you will answer as we desire. In a time of war, your soldiers will march to the call, and under the banner of Menzo Berenzon, and under the command of the Bayenri garrison. Your prayers to Lady Lolth will confirm these truths. Are we agreed?
Matron Xerith nodded.
My family is humbled by the great respect and opportunity Lady Lolth has offered us. Cusor Lauren stands with Menzo Berenzon in peace and in war.
You are our eyes to the world above, and the implements of your master smiths will sound gloriously throughout the tunnels of the Underdark,
Matron Mez Barris added, and everyone in the room knew that she had done so merely to interject her voice into a discussion so clearly dominated by Matron Mother Quenthal. These events were moving along without Mez Barris's consent, without her opinion even.
Is it your decision to remove yourself to your settlement at this time?
Matron Mother Quenthal asked Matron Xerith.
Yes, she answered. I will depart Menzo Berenzon within the 10 day.
And so your seat?
Matron Xerith took a deep breath, glanced across the way to Matron Mez Barris's left, at Matron Vidalma Tlabar of the fourth house, Thayan Tlabar, and Xerith's most hated rival. Then she turned to her own right, to Matron Misri Misrim of a fifth house, another hated rival. Xerith stepped behind the chair and pushed it into the table, signaling that she was done.
Begone,
Matron Mother Quenthal told her coldly.
No more is this your place.
Without a bow, without a salute, without a word, Matron Xerith Cusor Lauren left the ruling council. The other remaining matrons stared at Matron Mother Quenthal for guidance, and Quenthal understood their anticipation. Was she commanding ascent, where each would step up one rank to replace the vacated third seat? Or was she to leave it open, inviting someone, anyone, to try for the rank, which would likely result in a house war? Or a third option, perhaps, a blend of orderly ascent and enjoyable chaos?
Matron Vidalma,
Matron Mother Quenthal said to the woman at Mez Barris's right, and the Matron Mother indicated the open chair. Vidalma Tlabar rose and paced the long way around the table so as to not walk behind her superiors, Bayenri and Armgo. With a superior look to the others in the room, she pulled back Xerith's seat and took her place as the matron of the third house of Menzo Berenzon.
Matron Misri,
Matron Mother Quenthal bade, and Misri reversed Vidalma's course, taking Vidalma's former seat in rank. And so it went for the next three, each matron ascending to the seat in the position immediately above their previous station, an orderly advancement for the fourth through eighth ranked houses, elevating them to the third through seventh position. When they were done, the seat diagonally across the table from the Matron Mother was left open. Matron Mother Quenthal said nothing for a long while, letting the others consider the possibilities.
Matron Preanel Duskrin,
Matron Mez Barris finally asked, referring to the matron of House Duskrin, currently the ninth house of Menzo Berenzon.
If Duskrin is awarded the eighth house, who here believes that it will be a lasting arrangement?
Matron Mother Quenthal said with a wicked little laugh, and the other matrons joined in, for her words rang of truth. House Hunsrin was currently ranked 11th in the city, but it was commonly conceded that Hunsrin could defeat any of the lesser houses with ease, and likely a few of the ruling houses as well. And particularly so with the new city of Cusor Lauren established, for House Hunsrin was a powerful economic force in Menzo Berenzon, and with many channels outside the city, spider-webbing out into the wider Underdark and even to the surface. Many in Menzo Berenzon had been expecting House Hunsrin to make a move on the ruling council for years now,
and only the web of alliances among the various other eight houses had kept Matron Shakti Hunsrin's hand at bay. House Duskrin had no such tight ties and would easily be picked off by House Hunsrin should Duskrin be elevated to the ruling council, everyone seated at that table believed. House Duskrin is ninth, and Matron Preyanel is prepared to take her rightful seat, Mes Baris pressed. Of course she did, Matron Mother Quenthal understood, for House Duskrin was a devout and fairly isolated clan, with few allies to protect it from House Hunsrin.